Hello, Blogging Heads Nation. Welcome to the latest edition of Dresbert. I am Daniel Dresner. I am a professor of international politics at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University, and I write the Spoiler Alerts blog at the Washington Post.
And I'm Heather Hurlburt, and I direct the New Models of Policy Change project at New America.
How are you doing on this lovely Thursday, Heather?
Oh, you know, this is the second day in a row that I have been dramatically late to a media event because of our crappy local transportation infrastructure. But that's another conversation. There's been an election since the last time you and I spoke.
Yes. And if memory serves, the Democrats did not do terribly well in that election.
Right. And we will spare our audience any more sort of particular gnashing and wailing over that. But there has now been this kind of interesting, or to my mind, more interesting discussion of what, if anything, does this mean for national security policy? Are we, in fact, at a moment where a bunch of things will get done, either in a bipartisan way or a partisan way, or are we sort of heading into even deeper and more vituperative gridlock for the next 2 years?
And I will ask you, Heather, you know, convince me, the deeply jaded academic, that something will somehow change as a result of this.
Yeah, I don't think much is going to change.
Dang it. All right. I'll switch roles to hopeful academic. Naive optimistic academic. I can make this case.
I can't wait to see your face as the naive hopeful academic.
Gosh, Heather, I think you're underestimating American democracy. Even there, my eyes couldn't quite do the naive thing. No, I will say this. So let me put it this way. You can argue that the election, without question, you know, obviously gives the Republicans control of both houses of Congress. But there are reasons to believe that more will get done in foreign policy over the next 2 years than would have been the case otherwise, for a couple of reasons. The first and just crudest one is that precisely because the Democrats now no longer control a chamber of Congress, the ability, not that it was great before, but the ability now of Obama to get anything through Congress in terms of his domestic policy agenda is extremely limited. Ergo, he will do the natural thing that most presidents do in their latter half of their second term, which is focus on foreign policy. So that's one argument that would suggest foreign policy will play a bigger role. A second argument is that there are some issues for which Harry Reid not running the Senate actually makes it possible for some things to get done that would not otherwise have gotten done.
Name one.
Trade Promotion Authority would be the most obvious.
Let's dig down into that. I mean, okay. Number one, you think Harry Reid was the problem with Trade Promotion Authority?
I don't think he was the only problem. I do think he was a big problem. I mean, it was Harry Reid that basically said, we're not talking about this until after the midterms.
I think you've got sort of cause and effect mixed up there. But
okay, go ahead.
So the first problem on trade is they actually have to get a trade deal first.
Well, no, but you can – I mean, now, hold on. This depends on the ordering, because you can argue that to some extent, an Obama administration that actually has TPA is more likely to get his counterparts to actually negotiate even more seriously than they have, because they recognize, oh, okay, with TPA, there's a likelihood that the deals are actually going to get through Congress.
That is true. You could also argue that there's no reason in hell to waste the political capital to get TPA until you're sure. You know, why would you get TPA just so that your successor can pass trade agreements? I mean, I see your argument from a policy point of view, from a political point of view, and more to the point, I haven't seen any evidence that they're going to walk in with TPA.
Right. Now, well, yeah, go ahead.
But the second thing I want to say is, and this to my mind is going to be one of the most interesting dynamics in D.C. in the next couple of years, is you're going to have some number of Republicans who won't want to vote for TPA or for any trade agreement just because Obama got it. And so Republican leadership is going to have to deal with that. And then there is the interesting question of whether we have some anti-trade Republicans. I don't know whether we do or not, but on every other issue, you have significant splits in the Republican caucus. So it's not, you know, a trade vote is going to have to be a truly bipartisan vote. And it's just not clear to me that you get there without having an actual agreement on the table.
These are all – I mean, look at this way. I actually wrote a blog post saying that I actually feel like when we talk about this, I kind of feel like Charlie Brown with the football, where, you know, there had been a lot of talk the week before and then the week after the midterm saying that one of the few things where there might actually be forward progress is on trade. And I've heard this song before, so so I share your skepticism on this. If I were to make a slightly more positive spin, I would say, first of all, I don't think there's that much of a split on the GOP side on trade deals. I mean, there might be a split literally in the tactical sense of some Republicans simply will not support Trade Promotion Authority because it empowers this president and would potentially deliver him a political win. In much the same way, by the way, that Democrats post 2006 did not want to give George W. Bush Trade Promotion Authority for the very same reason. So that part I will grant you. But I would suspect that there is enough of a bipartisan support for these deals, you know, for TTIP and for TPP, such that if, in fact, the administration actually wanted to put its political weight behind it, I think they could get passage. It's that part that I'm actually dubious about, because what I do suspect is the case is that Republicans will not give TPA to the president out of the goodness of their hearts. They will want some sort of other element of compromise there. And that's where I do doubt – my doubt isn't about Congress. My doubt is about the Obama administration.
Well, wait. Okay. Why – just back up here. I mean, you should – you either give TPA because you think – more free trade is a good idea, or you don't give TPA because you don't think more free trade is a good idea, or you think that, you know.
What, are you crazy? Have you been paying attention to Congress for the last, you know, since the Republicans took over? The Republicans aren't going to do anything unless they feel like they somehow extract something, some form of other policy concession from the administration.
Okay, I'm just pointing out that's not, in fact, sort of, that's not like gravity. Or, except it is like gravity.
It is like, I mean, if you're saying it could. Would the Republicans suddenly smack their heads and say, well, wait a minute, why do we have to demand anything? This is, you know, serves our interests anyway. That's not how it works anymore. So call me.
I stand chastised, or I okay. sit chastised.
So anyway, right. the point being that it is, let me put it this way, I think it's possible that this will happen. I agree with you. If it was sort of like a probability thing, I think maybe the percentage, like the probability of TPA going through is now, let's say, 35%, whereas I thought it was 30% before the midterms. But you're right that I think in some ways this is a delicate dance, that you want there to be evidence that TTIP and TPP are also moving forward, because that makes it an easier vote for the members of Congress. So I agree with you that, that on the one hand, you know, getting TPA strengthens the Obama administration's position negotiating vis-a-vis its trade partners. But that said, forward momentum on trade negotiations would also make TPA passage quicker or easier.
The other really interesting issue dynamic that I'm keeping my eye on, frankly, is what happens to Pentagon spending. Because you have the Pentagon and its friends in both parties yelling very loudly about needing to modify or get rid of the provisions of sequestration, which impose flat across the board cuts to Pentagon spending or caps on Pentagon spending, so that you can't – it's not just cutting spending. It's cutting spending in ways you have no control over.
Right.
So, however, there is a – so, you know, Democrats, of course, would like to lift the domestic sequester.
Yeah.
GOP has no interest and no incentive to lift the domestic sequester. And you have a minority, but a significant minority of Republicans in the House who don't want to lift either one. So you could get to this, you could, you know, it's also, frankly, it suits everyone except the Pentagon for sequester to stay in place and everyone to be able to blame the other party for it. So
right, it is an issue for 2016, yeah.
So then the question is sort of, is ISIS so scary that someone actually tries to move a bill and fight it through, or do we continue this game where each side, rather than get the money it wants, would prefer to keep the other side from getting the money it wants, even though the really interesting thing is that Pentagon spending is now kind of the center against the edges.
This is a very insidery question, so I'm going to ask you, which is, do you think the fact that McCain is probably going to be chairing the Senate Armed Services Committee, and McCain, say what you will about him, does have a genuine record of bipartisanship on this sort of thing, does that increase the likelihood that you would actually, because I assume the Senate is the bigger veto point than the House on this.
Yeah, but this is an appropriations thing, not an authorizing thing.
Oh,
so
fair point.
Not.
See, you just. I'm the naive academic. I forgot that this has nothing to do with armed services.
You know. By the way, pro tip for the folks at home: if you want to sound smart and immediately shoot down your opponent in a conversation, you say, well, the authorizers really have much less power than everyone thinks, or really, that's a matter for the appropriators.
There you go. Nicely. So. That was a power move, Heather. I respect that.
So you two, you can do this at home.
I mean, in terms of the aggregate thing, I mean, in some ways, we should probably segue because in some ways, the question about what Obama will do in terms of foreign policy also points to something that he was frankly doing before the midterms anyway, which is that on a number of key areas, he's basically signaled that he's not going to go to Congress to get approval for whatever it is he's doing. So if you think about, for example, the climate change deal that was announced with China in the week after the midterms, which is a big deal, you know, one of the things that clearly had Republicans grumbling was the fact that, you know, he's going to implement this through EPA action rather than going to Congress. And, you know, increasingly what it looks to me like, if there is an Iran deal that actually is reached in the next week, and I'm not terribly confident that's going to happen, but assume that it does. Again, I don't think he's going to Congress with it.
So just one thing on that. I do have to say one thing about the election results that gives me a small measure of satisfaction.
Yes.
Is that it was widely reported that the Iranians had drawn the conclusion that Obama was holding a better offer for them until after the midterms. And so they would be smart to, as they have now done, spin things out until after the election. And
oops.
So which, you know, anyone could have told them beforehand. They, you know, as I said to somebody, this is the drawback of thinking that you know a lot about the politics of another country. So on the one hand, you could see how someone might draw that conclusion about the U.S. It's just that it was clearly wrong.
I fear the Iranians might have. I don't know if you're a fan of these. I love Josh Keating's essays at Slate that report on the United States as a journalist, you know, as an American journalist covers like an exotic foreign land. And I'm beginning to wonder if maybe the Iranians took Josh's reportage seriously. Not that he reported about this, but like, you know, they take that style of reporting seriously.
Yeah, or that again, you fail to appreciate that the legislature actually has influence in our brand of constitutional democracy.
Right, and that it's not like the president can just sort of manipulate the, you know, the composition of Congress to stack the deck with his supporters and so forth.
Right.
Yeah.
Anyway, so I agree with you that we're still 50-50 to get a deal, in part because I do think the Iranians were expecting more concessions to come in at the end. And so it's not clear to me they've gone through the work of sort of, no, this is really what their bottom line is. Can we live with it? You know, funnily enough, if the talks actually do break down and there isn't a deal, then there will be a crazy amount of bipartisan comedy on the Hill in terms of piling more sanctions on the Iranian government. So
yes, it'll be sanctioner than thou. As, you know, we should just like dub that as a term.
Yes. Okay. But Dresner has hereby trademarked sanctioner than thou.
Sanctioner than thou. Exactly. But let's play optimist and assume that a deal is cut. Can I ask you a question? Which is, I am a little bit concerned. I understand tactically why the administration is doing what it's doing on both climate change and on Iran, because with the recognition that congressional approval is not very likely, I can see why they're basically going to say, look, we're just going to have to do this through, you know, an array of executive actions plus, you know, implementing whatever laws have already been passed. But I am a little bit concerned, like, you know, long term about what this means. Which is not to say that every single foreign policy action should get congressional approval, but, you know, climate change and a nuclear and, you know, lifting the sanctions on Iran are not insignificant moves. And I do worry that if Obama signs something and you have a Republican elected president in 2016, what does he wind up doing with these sorts of deals?
So I will add to your list that actually the thing that I find most concerning has been the willingness to prosecute the war against ISIS without going to Congress. And both the sort of success of pressure from voices like Tim Kaine in Congress saying, hey, no, we have to vote on this. But also there's a certain amount of cynicism of, you guys said you wanted to vote on this? Okay, go ahead.
Yeah.
Write me something. So So on the one hand, yes, there's a really significant problem about the role of the executive versus the role of the legislative body. Now, this is another kind of fun folks at home moment. As Heather realizes to herself that she needs to have as talking points before the 24th, when the deal either happens or doesn't happen with the Iranians, sort of what are comparable moments in American foreign policy in the past, and have they or haven't they been blessed by Congress? Because I do think we're kind of talking about apples, oranges, kittens, and puppies.
Is going to be the name of my solo album, by the way, just so you know. But go ahead.
And then I'll have a little disclaimer that says no kittens or puppies were harmed in the making of this album.
Exactly, yes.
Apples and oranges, yes, sorry about that.
They were totally consumed. But yeah. So go ahead. How are we talking about disparate objects here?
Well, I am thinking through this as we go, and yeah. I'm also like sort of laughing at myself that this is exactly the kind of thing that by next week all of the advocates of an agreement will have to have stone cold 3-sentence talking points on why they're totally different. You're seeing the sausage inside.
Well, okay, let me help you making the sausage. I'm trying to think of instances in which the United States has by and large adhered to an agreement that an executive has either signed on or indicated that they will abide by without congressional approval. And the things that come to mind immediately are START II and the UN Law of the Sea Treaty.
The Helsinki Accords, which are...
Did the Helsinki Accords never got passed?
The Helsinki Accords are not legally binding. Everything in the Helsinki process is only politically binding, ironically, because the Soviets wanted... Well, no, I'm kidding.
No.
We wanted it that way, and we've always kept it that way. But yeah, no, the Helsinki Accords, everything except the CFE treaty is politically binding.
Right, so
that's a big one.
Okay.
Although
all of these are multilateral, whereas the deals were... I'm trying to think of a bilateral...
No, but
Accord.
This is multilateral. This is multilateral.
Oh, that's true. That is true. The Iran one is. Not the one with China, but...
Right.
Those are the categories I can think of. And the problem with all of those, really the one that is probably the best example is START II, because that's one that was negotiated and it was signed. And the Reagan came to power and was campaigned, among other things, against START II. He didn't like the idea of these sorts of treaties. But actually, if memory serves, they kind of adhered to the agreement. There was a brief moment where they flirted, with not doing it, and then eventually got overtaken by the collapse of the Soviet Union. But I remember that in the mid-80s, that it was clear that some members of the administration wanted to walk away from it, but they didn't.
Another category of agreements that I think are highly relevant here are incidents at sea agreements.
Okay.
Which are highly technical and, sort of relevant only to the two militaries, but also highly useful in avoiding, inadvertent thermonuclear war.
Yes. Which, by the way, let's thumbs up, because that was one of the – I mean, China and the United States signed 3 deals. Everyone's focusing on the climate change one.
Yeah.
The other two were equally important. The Information Technology Agreement was a big deal for the WTO and actually gives the U.S. greater access to Chinese markets. And they also signed a memorandum of understanding regarding naval incidents.
And that, I believe, is a category of agreement that is traditionally not in treaty form.
That's pretty damn anodyne. I mean...
No, but as I said, it's anodyne, but supremely important. And, I mean, the interesting thing, if you think about it, is there's huge congressional opposition to having one of those with Cuba.
Yeah, okay, fair enough.
So that's another, that's it. And so, but I think the other question that you're really asking, Dan, which I actually think is, pro tip?
Mm-hmm.
When you realize that you don't have the killer 3-sentence, you're wrong because, then you reframe the question your opponent is asking. And so, Dan, I think.
Sorry, I'm kind of, go ahead.
Man, this is valuable stuff, and I'm giving it away for free here.
This is true. You're really you're dishing all the trade secrets. You got to save this stuff for your memoirs or for a how-to book at least. But sorry, go ahead. So, what do you think my question really is about, Heather?
Your question is really about in an increasingly sort of technical and age of so much information, what is the role of the legislative body in international affairs?
Okay.
But it's a real question. I came up with a real question. You're laughing at me, but
I am laughing, but go ahead. Yes. All right.
No. So how do we get Congress to be able to weigh in meaningfully on any of these issues that you and I have raised? Where we have, I mean, you know, a Congress that's so manifestly ignorant about science, or a Congress that, you know, certainly doesn't understand, what a centrifuge is, or a Congress that, doesn't believe in climate change. So,
okay, come on. Now, even the Republicans have shifted. I mean, you can hear this post midterms that the Republicans have even shifted their rhetoric on the climate change thing. They're no longer saying I'm not a scientist. You know that they're actually saying yes, there's climate change, that it is man made. But then the question is, what are we going to do about it? And that's where you can have a genuine policy dispute. But go ahead.
The thing I liked was that there is climate change and it's all feminists' fault.
Who said that? That one, that's a new one.
It's a joke, but it's an excellent joke in that it sums up several major trends of current politics. But there is, I mean, quite a part, and I guess, so the reason that you have treaties, right, is that you have a particular set of formal specific legal obligations that have very specific legal definition.
Right.
The climate agreement in particular, I don't see how, if what you're doing in the agreement is setting targets, that's not what treaties do.
Well, okay, so I would push back on the following way, which is in some ways the one, you know, from international relations theory, we know that the truly important thing that democratically elected legislatures do is that they create the possibility of credible commitment by democracies in a way that doesn't necessarily happen with other types of regimes. So, you know, say what you will about the United States, and you're right, it's getting tougher to pass treaties or, you know, congressional executive agreements, which only require majority approval of both houses rather than two-thirds of the Senate. It's tougher to get that approval. The thing is that once those things get approved, that's it. They're locked in.
So two things. One is, it does seem to me that you totally fell into my trap, that what this is in fact really about is how does the legislative engage in international affairs, right? But two, in recent years, it's also become clear that it's not true that once you get agreement, you're locked in. I mean, you have, you know, you have the Bush administration that unsigned a treaty. You have Congress passing legislation to try to block treaties that have been signed. So
I mean, hold on. You know, I did fall into your trap, but I'm gonna fight my way out, which is that, you know, the Bush administration said, you know, basically renounced treaties that the Clinton administration had signed, but clearly was not going, we're never going to get through Congress. So you can argue that in some ways the Bush administration did what the Reagan administration didn't do with START II. So I'll grant you that. And they pulled out of one treaty. They pulled out of the ABM treaty with Russia, which in some ways was unheard of, but in other ways was perfectly legally fine, because they gave due notification and so on and so forth.
But just pause for a second, because you just did something very clever there, which was you just redefined to it was perfectly legally fine.
Yes.
And so notice when you're struggling a little bit, you shift the ground on which you're arguing. And that was a master stroke by you there.
Thank you very much. But I mean, so to get back to my original question, though, in some ways, what the Obama administration is doing is trying to send a signal that it will, that it will try to faithfully execute these agreements. The problem is that in bypassing Congress, you have to wonder if our counterparts are going to look at this stuff and to what extent do, you know, people that are trying to negotiate with the administration have to calculate the odds that these deals will be renounced come 2017, or if not 2017, then 2021 or what have you.
Mm-hmm. Now, that's a real concern. And I actually also agree with you that the most important reason to get a treaty ratified is to get both parties on record, or large numbers of representatives on record voting for it. Actually, more for domestic reasons even than for international reasons.
Yeah.
So I'm totally in agreement with you that it's desirable. If I'm a foreign leader looking at the current state of U.S. politics, though, I look at just about anything and I think, okay, what are the forces that I need to have on the side of this agreement to make sure that it doesn't get repealed in 2017? And I'm not sure that my first thought is, oh, some percentage of the current elected government has to vote. Sorry, my cell phone is ringing in the background there.
Mm-hmm.
At least I didn't pick it up and answer it.
Also, that's a power move, by the way. This is a pro tip at home. You know, have the phone go off and then ignore it, which simultaneously indicates that you're powerful, but also recognizes, you know, is a nice gesture to the other person.
I'm only aware of one of our professional colleagues who does the power move of having the phone ring and picks it up and answers it in the middle of other stage presentations.
Oh, God, I forgot. Yes.
Which is kind of uniquely a unique power move. Just goes to show you can have your own individual style.
Yes. Let's go forward, though, without naming that person.
Right, before we do any more sub-cheating.
Yes. Sorry. Anyway.
I forget what I was saying, so I think you win.
Okay, there we go. I guess my one question is that you've been paying, I think, probably a little more attention to the Iran negotiations than I have. But I have to say, there seems to be a rhythm to these sorts of things, which is everything I read says massive efforts are being put forward to try to, you know, like both sides are very serious, their intent. And yet when you actually see the proposals, there hasn't been much in the way of forward progress. And so I don't know. I'm pretty dubious that actually there's going to be a deal cut.
So the way I would slightly correct that is that there's actual language, sort of substantive annexes drafted on a lot of issues. There are two issues where not much progress has been made, and one is how sanctions will be removed, and the other is how many centrifuges Iran gets to have and what it gets to do with them.
Right.
So in each case, basically, the issue that's core to the other side is the one where there hasn't been movement. Now,
other than that, everything's fine.
No, but there's two things that could mean, right? And the pessimistic thing is, you know, ultimately neither side is prepared to go where it would have to go to get a deal, or one side isn't, you know, I don't know. The optimistic way of looking at it is, everyone is waiting until the absolute last minute, and at the absolute last minute, you know, it's sort of, okay, so we've known all along here are the two number parameters, here are the $2 parameters, and we're going right down the middle or wherever we're going, and then we draft the language and we have the deal.
I will say this, you're right, and it raises the really interesting question of the extent to which the deadline of November 24th will wind up being an impediment, or is it actually the sort of, you know, the shotgun to the head that actually inspires a real deal. And it'll be interesting to see which is the answer.
On the Iran, the speculation about the Iran, you know, my sense is that the administration knows what its bottom line is and has known for a while. The sense of the Iranian side is that ultimately it has to go to the Supreme Leader. The Supreme Leader has not tipped his hand. And that it may very well be that even the Iranian negotiators don't know if the best deal they can get is good enough for the Supreme Leader. You will recall that a few years ago there was a small deal that was actually agreed in Geneva, and then the Supreme Leader, they took it back home to Tehran, scotched it. So that is kind of the unknown here.
Yeah, and it'll be interesting to see going forward. But we should actually continue the theme of the Obama administration acting in a sort of executive fashion as a way to implement. And this is, this does to me count at least somewhat as foreign policy, which is, I believe he's giving a televised address tonight on his moves on immigration. That essentially, you know, this notion of a immigration reform, which had was one of those things that was talked about as potentially being a bipartisan thing after the 2012 election. And apparently were secret negotiations between Obama and John Boehner all throughout the year. And yet after the election, essentially the administration is just going to go forward and implement this via executive action, which, as I understand it, is simultaneously A, legal, but B, somewhat unprecedented. But is part and parcel of this larger thing of the president simply saying, okay, I'm just going to use my executive authority if I can't get something through Congress.
Well, the thing that's kind of silly about this is that from my understanding of what's in the executive order, which is not exactly deep in, you know, nobody from the White House called me up and briefed me on it. But what's in it, it's not a substitute in any way for comprehensive immigration reform.
Right.
That it creates one additional class of people who are allowed to stay here, and it makes explicit sort of how ICE is supposed to prioritize pursuit and deportation. Which, mm-hmm. I mean, this all gets discussed as if, well, since he couldn't do comprehensive immigration reform, or he chose to do this, since it's not the same thing, you know? It's like, well, because I couldn't go to the hospital and have my limb reattached, I put a Band-Aid over the wound.
That's a good move. I like that PR move. I guess my question, though, is that by doing this, he's guaranteed, essentially, that at best there will only be the Band-Aid. The question
now
is,
put your hand up if you believe there was going to be something other than the Band-Aid.
I am not putting my hand up, I admit.
Me neither.
So that's a fair point. Okay. Do you think, I mean, I guess my question is that, are you concerned, though, that this will lead to something like another government shutdown, or, you know, basically attempts by Congress to reassert its control over policy by, I don't know, you know, not funding certain aspects of the U.S. government or what have you?
Well, there's no question that there's a minority of congressional Republicans who are looking for excuses to shut down the government and
right.
do things like that. And so you have this problem of, yes, this is certainly going to give them a pretext. If it hadn't been this, it would have been something else. So
although I think this is actually one case where the depth of the Republican victory during the midterms ironically decreases the likelihood of this happening. Because it does give both John Boehner and Mitch McConnell a little more wiggle room than they had before. The thing about particularly the last Congress, or since 2010, was that because Nancy Pelosi had the Democrats so united, Boehner needed his entire House caucus to be able to do anything. And since his margin of victory was ridiculously small or thin, particularly post-2012, he really was held hostage by his most extreme members of his party. They now have, what, a 30-seat margin?
I think that's right.
Yeah, which means that, you know, he's got a bigger cushion than he used to, and when that's significant.
Yeah, and that is, the other side of that, which is interesting, is that the magnitude of the Republicans' victory suggests that maybe waiting until after the election to do this executive order actually wasn't the smart political move that it seemed
yeah.
like.
It never did seem like a smart political move to me, to be honest, but that's it's easy for me to say ex post. I just never quite got that, but.
Right. No, I mean, people clearly, you know, again, I would tend to agree with you, but it is ironic, I think, or it's maybe not even, maybe it's interesting that
it's Alison Moore said ironic.
Before, yeah, I was trying to move away from that.
Sorry,
exactly
right,
that. I can never get that out of my head when I, but,
yes.
but that both before and after the election, immigration reform was used to explain or excuse other things.
Right.
Right?
No, that's
so,
fair. We should switch to one last thing, which I will talk about, which is there was a story in the Washington Post yesterday, I believe, by Greg Miller, that apparently John Brennan has sort of commissioned a small group at the CIA to engage in what sounds like a pretty radical overhaul of the CIA's organization. That ever since the CIA has been around, that it's had this sort of four different divisions. One is the Directorate of Operations, that's the clandestine service. One is the Director of Intelligence, which is mostly analysts. There is also one, I believe, that does logistics, and there's a final one that is escaping me now. I can't remember the name of it, but also sort of handles support services. And essentially what the proposal is that the CIA will be reorganized rather than those four different directorates, more along the lines of the way that the CTC is set up, the Counterterrorism Bureau, the one that got bin Laden, where you have small clusters that are focused on regional areas, and a combination of, you know, actual operational agents, as well as analysts, as well as support personnel. And then I believe these sort of fusion of different disciplines will allow them to be, you know, sort of more nimble and better at the op, you know, sort of dealing with operational tasks. And the take I had it, you know, Michael Hayden's one of the people that's consulted on this, and Hayden has pushed back, you know, arguing that this could be a real problem because it could erode the sort of training that people have for the more at sort of more general level, that they wind up sort of focusing exclusively on one region, and also that if the analysts and the operatives are too close to each other, then that eliminates the ability for more dispassionate analysis. I tend to be less concerned about that. I'm actually inclined to think this is a pretty good idea if you have like a China cluster and a Syria cluster and a Russia cluster and so forth. With one key caveat, which is this assumes that you then are essentially transferring the sort of role of longer range and medium range strategic analysis from the CIA to ODNI, to the Director of National Intelligence. And this would actually make some sense because ever since the DNI was created, I think back in 2005, there's always been this lack of clarity between, you know, nominally the ODNI is always the CIA head's boss, and yet since the CIA had so much of the capabilities, not to mention NSA and the other intelligence services, it was never clear what the DNI could do. And this actually clarified a division of labor as well as allowed for a reorganization of the CIA. That would potentially be a good thing.
Yeah, there has been conversation among intel professionals since 2001 about, you know, the extent to which the community broadly and the CIA in particular had not fully and successfully made the transition to the post-Cold War era.
Right.
And, you know, what's interesting to me is that this reform, the way it's described, doesn't immediately seem to me as if it addresses that problem.
Possible.
And so I guess I query making that kind of org chart change if you haven't, what problem are you addressing by doing that, I guess is my first question.
Mm-hmm.
My second question is, how are you going to manage those clusters, and how are you going to ensure that you have managers who can manage the very different needs and skill sets and, you know, promotion criteria of people in those clusters? You know, and I must say there is something to be said for keeping the ops people as far away from the analysts as possible.
Yeah, no, there are clearly virtues to the current system. I mean,
right.
I think it's a debatable proposition. Yeah,
and then the third point I would make is I do think we've had a number of indications in recent years that there are some big problems about internal accountability and internal clarity within the CIA. And so it does seem to me that when you have, people who aren't quite sure whether or not it's okay to go and search congressional computers.
Oh, yes.
That's a
fair point.
Whether or not, you know, going back to 2001, whether or not it's okay to engage in practices that are defined as torture. And there have been, you know, just every couple of years, there's been another sort of questionable thing. And again, most people at the CIA are very ethical, work very hard, really want to know what the norms are, really want to stay clearly on the right side of the law. But if you are having a problem with what are your norms and limits in a new age, creating a more murky administrative structure is going to be the opposite of helping you get your arms around that.
Those are fair pushback. I mean, I will say,
color me dubious.
Fair enough. I would say this. I hope that if they do this, they've consulting one of my good friends, but also someone who writes about this, Amy Ziegert, who has actually worked on intelligence reform and published two books about it, and points out the very sort of organizational cultural problems that you're talking about.
Yeah, and I guess the last thing I would say, having recently worked, having recently consulted with a nonprofit that was going through organizational reform, is there is, you know, none of our institutions is immune from the idea that sort of moving the boxes on the org chart magically fixes things.
Yeah, we're in the middle of a strategic planning process at the Fletcher School, so I know of what
I'm
you speak.
I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry to hear that. And, you know, the truth is, like, if you have a problem of organizational culture, there is no substitute for actually addressing head-on the problem of organizational culture.
That, I think, should be the final word, because that is a great closing sentence. With that, we're off to Halifax, right?
Yes, I'm off to Halifax and then home for Thanksgiving. And you?
Excellent. I will be hosting Thanksgiving. I look forward to that. I have this weird – I actually get off on hosting large numbers of people with cooking. It's one of my – I don't know what it is. Maybe it's the Jewish mother in me or something, but I love, like, making Thanksgiving feasts. So I'm
so desperately hoping that you deep fry a turkey in your yard.
No. I do I'm sorry. We do the turkey traditionally, but I also grill a lamb. That's important.
Yeah, we actually slow smoke the turkey.
Oh, that is good.
Yes.
I just use a lot of, we make a lot of juice, a lot of juicy, some bacon and a fair amount of pork, which really does make the turkey pretty nice.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, on that note, we will see you and all of our fans in December.
Everyone have a good November. Take care.
Bye-bye.